Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Much has changed in Russia over the past decade and more since the fall of the Soviet Union. It was certainly the case that the Soviet Union severely restricted access to such topics as sex and religion. But has that changed in the new Russia? That will be the topic of Terry Clark's conversation this week with Mariana Tax Cholden. But before we get to that, let's take a look at an event that occurred this week in history. 50 years ago this week, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, defendants in one of the most controversial trials of the 20th century, were sentenced to death following their conviction on charges of spying for the Soviet Union. The trial occurred at the height of the Cold War. Confessions by associates of Klaus Fuchs, a British scientist who gave atomic secrets to the Soviets while working on the Manhattan Project, led FBI investigators to the Rosenbergs. Investigators found that Julius was a communist who began to spy for the Soviets by stealing manuals for radar tubes, and that by the late 1940s he had two apartments set up as microfilm laboratories. David Greenglass, a small-time spy associate of Julius, further incriminated the Rosenbergs by testifying that Julius ordered him to hand over to Soviet agents a design of the atomic bomb used at Nagasaki. On March 29th, the couple was convicted, but the Rosenbergs still insisted they were innocent and began to write poignant letters that were widely published. Despite protests and several attempts at an appeal, the Rosenbergs were executed on June 19, 1953. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, in Savannah, Georgia, a city with a past haunted by slavery, not a single plaque, pillar, or statue stands in tribute to blacks who suffered the horrors of bondage. The long-overdue $350,000 African-American monument, showing a black family with broken chains at their feet, is proposed for construction on the promenade by the Savannah River, one of the hottest tourist spots in the city. However, the words that many want inscribed at its base has raised a storm of controversy. Attributed to poet Maya Angelou, the quotation reads, "We lay back to belly in the holds of the slave ships in each other's excrement and urine together. Sometimes died together, and our lifeless bodies thrown overboard together." No one denies the passage's brutal truth, but critics say it is too harsh for a monument that is to be erected in a popular tourist spot. The city council approved the monument 2 months ago, but has yet to approve the quotation. Nauticus, a deep-sea salvage company based in Hanover, Maryland, was searching for a sunken Israeli submarine when it came across more than it bargained for. Instead of a submarine, the crew uncovered what they claim is an ancient Greek trading vessel shipwrecked over 2,300 years ago. Found nearly 2 miles under the surface of the Mediterranean, 300 miles off the coast of Corsica, the discovery could change current theories about ancient Greek trade routes. This is Talking History. Welcome back. For our interview this week, Talking History's Terry Clark and his guest Mariana Tax Cholden examine changes in censorship in the new Russia.
In the view of some, the Soviet Union was a totalitarian state. Others argued that it was far less monolithic, marked instead by a vast array of powerful bureaucratic agencies in competition with each other. Regardless of the model one uses to understand the Soviet Union, most agree that the regime severely restricted the information available to its citizens. This was particularly the case concerning such sensitive topics as religion and sex. But what of the new Russia? How has Russia dealt with information on these topics? Here to discuss the issue of censorship in the new Russia is Professor Mariana Tax Cholden. Professor Cholden is the C. Walter and Gerda B. Mortensen Distinguished Professor at the Library of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She is also a past president of the American Association for the Advancement of Slavic Studies and a recipient of the Pushkin Gold Medal for contributions to culture awarded her by the Russian government. She is best known for her books, A Fence Around the Empire, Russian Censorship of Western Ideas Under the Tsars, and The Red Pencil, Artists, Scholars, and Censors in the USSR. Welcome to our show, Professor Cholden.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
You know, most of us, at least in my generation, and I'm sure yours as well, and most of our listeners, grew up with this image of a tightly censored Soviet Union or tight censorship. And that was particularly the case regarding such sensitive issues as sex, drugs, religion. Just how tight was Soviet censorship of these topics and others like them?
Well, it was extremely tight. It's hard for us here to even imagine how tight it was. That isn't to say that it was perfect, because no censorship is perfect, but it came as close as any system probably could, particularly during certain parts of the Soviet era. Under Stalin, for example, it reached extraordinary levels. But it was very, very tight indeed. All information flow was controlled from the top. It was a system that is, in my understanding of things, unique in the world, in that it's unlike any other censorship system that we think of when we think of censorship, in that it was completely unacknowledged publicly by the government, in fact, indeed, denied by the government, and yet it existed as such a far-reaching, deep, comprehensive system of control over information that, in effect, everybody became a censor, and everybody was subject to censorship. It was quite an extraordinary system.
This had, as I'm hearing described, this had to have a serious impact on science, did it not?
Very serious impact on all kinds of science. Dramatic cases of that people, many people have heard of course, are under Stalin, when biology, the science of biology, for example, was pretty much completely destroyed by the introduction, the forced acceptance of the biology of a Soviet scientist named Lysenko, and the complete rejection of modern genetics as it was practiced, set back Soviet biology by generations. That's an extreme example, but in fact, science overall was affected by the extreme secrecy, by the inability of scientists to communicate across sort of horizontally with each other, and by many other factors, had a very, very crippling effect on science and on social science. The science, the study of society and of the human mind, so sociology, psychology, and disciplines like that, were extremely distorted because the only acceptable way of thinking about society and about human behavior was in strictly Marxist terms, as they were defined in the Soviet philosophy. So lots of science was crippled.
I was surprised as I was listening to your answers to my first question as well, and you were saying that, of course, it was much a tighter censorship under Stalin, but throughout it was tight. What about eras, though, like the thaw that we've heard about under Khrushchev, where there was supposed to be greater access, at least in literature?
Yeah, well, the thaw was indeed a thaw. It was indeed a thaw, but remember what a thaw is if we want to look figuratively out of our windows, those of us who are living in areas covered by snow right now. A thaw just means it's a little bit warmer, and there's a little dripping and a little melting and a little bit of slush. It's not as though it were a complete sudden meltdown. And so while it, in contrast to what was before, it was a dramatic change, it didn't immediately affect the situation to make everything dramatically better. A lot of important things happened during those 10 years of thaw. A generation came of age that had a different way of thinking about things, and that became extremely important later on when things really did change. The Gorbachev generation came of age then, and during that period or shortly after it, during it and shortly after it, you had great events that began to shake the Soviet state, although it was much too early to see what effect they were going to have. You had the Hungarian uprising, then later you had the Prague Spring, and the people who came of age in that thaw period began to look differently at a lot of the things that were going on around them. And I'm sure it's not only I, but many specialists agree that it's the events of that era that began to really form the momentum that was going to be able to make cracks in the system.
How did the collapse of the Soviet Union has it changed this situation or this as you've described it to us?
Oh, dramatically. Now we can use the word dramatically. And in fact, when you look back over what is a mere decade, just 10 years, it's hard to recognize the old place because things in this area have changed so enormously and so deeply. But there is still a mentality problem, and this is something that I think we all need to be aware of. We know it from our own experience as well, that you can change a lot of physical things, and you can change the way things, you can change the technology, and you can change the mechanics of how things work. But the hardest thing of all to change is the human mind and the habits that we were born and bred with, and those die. Those changes are harder to affect. And so, yes, it's changed a lot, and yes, there's still a way to go.
What about now? What are the big issues or the hot issues when it comes to information access?
Well, certainly issues of secrecy and national security still remain high in the minds of the authorities, and that's not surprising. They're high in the minds of the authorities in every country. We know that in our own country as well. But recent examples, for example, the secrecy that they tried to impose over the accident, the Kursk, the tragedy of the submarine, the recent court case, although it had a happy ending, but there was a long and drawn-out court case about an environmental scientist who was trying to reveal some of the environmental disasters in the Soviet Union. These harken back to the old days, and they are kind of concern that's still present now. And, you know, as I said, I don't think we can expect any society, any country to be free of those kinds of concerns on the part of the government. But what we need to expect, what you hope for, is a system operating in the country that will counter that kind of pressure that comes from the government, and that isn't really in place yet. So that's an issue that's on people's minds. Other areas that are sensitive, again, they're not too surprising. Many of these same words are going to pop up in other countries. Religion. Hate and violence, sex and pornography. These are issues that tend to be hot button issues in lots of countries, and they certainly are in post-Soviet Russia as well.
Interesting set of topics.
Yeah.
How are the Russians dealing with information about sex?
Well, they're really not dealing with it. Really, for much of the past decade, sex has really come out of the closet there. I guess what one has to remember is that something that I didn't mention about the Soviet system is that it was an extraordinarily prudish and Victorian society when it came to control of literature and film and other things having that would portray in any way sexuality. So publications were scanned very carefully for any four-letter words or any kind of improper language. Films were scanned very carefully before they were released for anything that might be seen as being too prurient. Very Victorian approach to things. So once the controls were lifted, anything goes. And there isn't yet the kind of, for example, the sort of zoning that we have in American cities where you can have your adult bookstores and your sex shops and so on, but they're in certain areas. They have very strict regulation in terms of what can be displayed in the windows. There are age limits about, you know, who can enter such a place and who can be sold such material and so on. And so there's some attempt by local society communities to keep that kind of material controlled in some way. One may or may not agree with this, but this is kind of the way it is. Well, that isn't present at all yet in Russia. I suspect it will come. So people, on the one hand, you can buy hardcore pornography just about anywhere, and as a reaction to that, I suppose people are quite outraged about it. So it's still at a stage. I always tell my Russian friends, just, you know, keep working at this and have patience. It will fall into place. People lose their enormous fascination with something that they can get more freely to, and what you're seeing partly is a reaction to years of being kept from such things. That's a natural reaction.
You mentioned religion is another one of the hot button issues.
Yeah.
That can be a really touchy one if it's mixed with what issues of race or ethnicity.
Oh yes, and this is truly a hot button in Russia, because one of the nasty things, of course, that crawled out from under the rocks when the Soviet state fell apart was nationalism and ethnic hatreds and race issues that had been present, of course, always, because they're present in any human society, unfortunately. But under the Soviet government, they were firmly held down. And now that that control is no longer there, we see all those things popping up. So, of course, the most obvious thing is the war in Chechnya and the neighboring areas in the Caucasus, the Northern Caucasus, and that region. But in fact, you see a lot of tension throughout the society. And so in Moscow, for example, you have what we would consider unlawful search and seizure of dark-skinned people who are seen as coming up from the south, from the Caucasus, and maybe being dangerous, and then the police will apprehend them and do try to control their movements and search them and so on. And these are things that we hope don't happen in an orderly society. In terms of religion, again, you've got much more religious free expression than could ever have been dreamed of under the Soviet Union. All religion, of course, was seen as a bad thing in Marxism. It's the opiate of the people and so on, and you weren't supposed to have it. But Russians have always held on very strongly to the dominant religion, Russian Orthodoxy. But in addition, there are in the former Soviet Union a number of other religions that are important. There's a strong Jewish presence. There's a very strong Muslim presence. And there have been since long before the Russian Revolution, there have been strong but small groups of Protestants within the territory of what's now Russia. And after the fall of the Soviet Union, all of this began to bloom in some very good ways, but also some bad things started to happen. The Russian Orthodox Church, some elements of the church, I hasten to say that this is not all of the churchmen. I know some extremely liberal and moderate church people within the Russian Orthodox Church, but some took a very hardline position toward other religions. Now we're free, now we can practice religion, now we're going to have the Russian Orthodox Church in its old glory as it was before the revolution. And so there have been a lot of attempts on the part of the Russian Orthodox Church to sort of censor the activities and publications and access and so on of other religions within Christianity, let alone Judaism, Islam, and so on. There has been a resurgence of anti-Semitism. There was anti-Semitism all along in the Russian Empire. There was anti-Semitism coming directly from the state, often during the Soviet time. Now you're seeing again, and have seen since the fall of the Soviet Union, a resurgence of kind of more private kinds of anti-Semitism being expressed publicly. Rise of neo-Nazi types, as you see in other parts of Europe. This is all the kind of thing that goes along with openness, and it's the kind of thing that that is very upsetting, both to, you know, to a government and to the population, but it's something that a democracy has to learn how to deal with, and the Russians are struggling with it.
This has been a very interesting conversation. I actually wish we had more time.
I do too.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Professor Mariana Tax-Childen. She's the C. Walter and Gerda B. Mortensen Distinguished Professor at the Library of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
The recent presidential election was so close that some critics concluded that George Bush would enter the White House with no mandate from which to conduct the business of the presidency, and that he would be blocked at nearly every step by a nearly evenly balanced House and Senate. How would that affect American foreign policy? That is the subject of this week's op-ed, prepared for us by Michael Cresswell. Cresswell is a professor of history at Florida State University.
While President George W. Bush may face at least 4 years of legislative gridlock, that paralysis need not extend to foreign policy. The Constitution confers broad authority on the chief executive over foreign affairs. This authority offers a president considerable running room, and the 535 members of Congress find it exceedingly difficult to keep up with a nimble-footed chief executive. History suggests that even a president primarily committed to enacting a domestic agenda can achieve significant foreign policy successes. For example, Woodrow Wilson, who won less than 42% of the popular vote in 1912, took over a nation ideologically divided by the changes wrought by rapid industrialization. Although Wilson wanted to create a peaceful international political order based on the rule of law, he nonetheless pursued an interventionist foreign policy, sending military expeditions to Mexico in 1916 and Russia in 1918, and leading a reluctant United States into the First World War, pulling the Democratic Party along with him. His actions and ideals shaped the outlines of modern American foreign policy. Franklin Roosevelt was another domestic president who made his mark on foreign policy. First elected in 1932, Roosevelt became president of a nation weakened by the Great Depression and wedded to isolationism. After expending considerable energy and political capital in launching the New Deal, Roosevelt, before he died in 1945, wrenched America from its isolationist moorings and helped lead the United States to victory in the greatest military conflict in history. Lyndon Johnson confronted an even more daunting task than that facing Bush. Not only did Johnson reach the Oval Office following the assassination of John F. Kennedy in November 1963, but he took over a nation in the midst of a civil rights movement and an expanding war in Southeast Asia. Johnson also had an extremely ambitious domestic policy program, the Great Society. While the Vietnam War must weigh negatively in any evaluation of Johnson's presidency, we should not overlook his many foreign policy accomplishments. These successes included negotiating the Non-Proliferation Agreement, which significantly lessened tensions with the Soviet Union, and holding together NATO while blunting French President Charles de Gaulle's challenge to the alliance. Johnson also successfully negotiated the 1964 through 1967 GATT round of multilateral trade agreements, the so-called Kennedy Round, demonetized gold, returned Iwo Jima to Japan in 1967, setting up the mechanism for the return of Okinawa 5 years later, and prevented a Cuban-style revolution from occurring in the Dominican Republic. While these examples tell us nothing about the foreign policy of the incoming Bush presidency, they reveal something about the nature of international politics. Unlike domestic policy, international politics has its own logic and grammar. Even absent a crisis abroad, a president can ultimately overcome domestic obstacles to his foreign policy. There are reasons for cautious optimism about the Bush administration's ability to surmount such obstacles. Although not a serious student of international affairs, Bush has surrounded himself with experienced hands. His primary foreign policy team of Vice President Dick Cheney, Secretary of State Colin Powell, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice possesses the combined experience, influence, and bureaucratic savvy to ensure that foreign policy is not neglected at the expense of domestic policy. Although the legislative branch may force the incoming president to make far-reaching compromises in his domestic agenda, this may not be the case for his foreign policy. Given his constitutionally mandated authority over foreign affairs, Bush could find that he has much greater running room for initiative overseas than at home.
You've been listening to Michael Cresswell, professor of history at Florida State University. Professor Cresswell's op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. Few of us, fortunately, have seen the inside of America's prisons. Even fewer have had the opportunity to look at their history. If the subject interests you, however, we have a most unusual museum to tell you about, where you can learn about the history of one of the nation's best-known jails, made even more famous by singer Johnny Cash. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Folsom Prison was made famous by Johnny Cash and his concert performed inside the prison walls in 1968, but the history behind those walls goes back much further, and the museum next door to the prison is a popular tourist attraction. The Folsom Prison Museum offers a look at torturous prison conditions in the decades after the California Gold Rush. You learn about the early day conditions of the prison from a Charles Bronson look-alike doll named Sam. On display, you will find examples of objects made by prisoners to help them escape, weapons fashioned from wood or paper, and even a toaster made from cardboard. The Prison Museum is only one of a handful in the United States and is operated by retired prison guards who opened the museum in the late 1980s. Admission is free, and most of the money from donations and the sale of souvenirs goes to charity.
Turning to our list of coming attractions, we have two programs to report on this week, both to air on the History Channel during the next few weeks. Just in time for Easter, on April 14th, the History Channel will premiere The Apostle Paul, the Man Who Turned the World Upside Down. The program tells the story of an ordinary man, Paul of Tarsus, who transformed the world when he chose to follow Jesus Christ. And on April 17th, watch for Crypts, Coffins, and Corpses, a fascinating, if at times gruesome, look at how different civilizations have treated the dead from ancient Egypt to the present, even taking a peek into the future. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact show times of these History Channel programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.